We thank you again for joining us for a very important session. Probably as a full-time people helper, if there's one thing that I see or our staff sees at Living Foundation Ministries, is that we see a great deal of childhood issues that are still being worked out in adult life. In fact, in our session here, I'd like to, if I may, just give you an indication how you and how I can reduce anger in our children. And notice I didn't say completely do away with it. Frankly, they're going to get angry. You're going to get angry. But we're talking about how in the world can you reduce anger in your children. And then, if you're an adult, looking back, how you can process anger that you have seen growing up in yourself as a result of some things that you went through as a child. One time I had a gentleman come to me, a pastor, and he shared with me that his dad asked him to clean out the garage. So he went out and he cleaned out the garage. And father left the home on an errand and came back. But when he came back, he walked down in the garage and he noticed underneath a cabinet that the son had not swept cleanly underneath a cabinet. And the father just went into a rage. And this young man, at that time, learned real quickly that no matter what I did or how hard I worked, I could not please my dad. A friend of mine named Kathy was talking to me. She was sharing that her mother and dad had some friends over for to play some cards or some kind of recreational game that they did every month. And Kathy, as a young child, decided that while her parents were doing that, she would do something special for her mother. So she went into the kitchen and went to the pantry. Now, most of us usually have a good hinged door in our pantry because that's just not one of the public display areas. But Kathy went in there, she opened up the pantry and took all the contents of the pantry out and then restocked the pantry, you know, cans in order, and straightened out very nicely. And she'd finished the project and went in to where her mother was, and they had finished the game. And she says, "Mommy, would you come out in the kitchen and see what I've done for you?" And so the mother, you know, excused herself, got up and walked in the kitchen, and she looked at the pantry, and she knew that she was still in earshot of the guests, and said, "Oh, Kathy, this is very nice what you've done. I really appreciate it." She really poured it on. Kathy was feeling just a tremendous amount of, "Whew, does that feel good?" However, once the guest left, the mother went into a rage. She called Kathy very, very strong, demeaning names, and told her, "Don't you ever, ever, ever again clean this pantry out in front of my company and embarrass me." Well, Kathy began to shrivel like a rose that's been handled too much. Began to wilt. And the little lines that you can see into a rose petal that's been crushed, her spirit was crushed inside. My friend Fred came in and to the office, and we were sharing together. His dad was a pilot, a Braniff airline pilot, and his father in the summer sent him out to the grandparents for 3 weeks, and he said, "At the end of 3 weeks, I'll send you a ticket and I want you to fly home." So he sent this Fred out there as a young boy. At the end of 3 weeks, no ticket came, and he called his dad, says, "Look, I'll be sending a ticket out to you. It'll be just a few more weeks." And so the weeks went on, and this happened two or three times till the end of the summer. Finally, the tickets came, and when Fred came home, Fred was greeted with a new sister. The shock, the disgust that came up. You see, what happened, that the father and the mother began to obsess on the little girl. They wanted a little girl. Fred was a boy. Fred could do nothing right. The daughter could do nothing wrong. In fact, one of the emotions that Fred struggled with was the emotion that he wanted to be a girl. Now, you and I sit there and say, well, that sounds a little perverted and distorted. Now, think it through. Think it through for a minute. If you grew up and the only person that you viewed was getting any kind of love and attention was a female, wouldn't you wish down deep that maybe you could be like them? So I'd never want to change my sex. Listen very carefully. Many of you right here, are wishing you were somebody else because you hear and see what this somebody else is getting that you're not getting. And you wish, you envy, and you wish you were them. But may I say to you, that's what happened to Fred. And Fred could not understand why he struggled. Now, he never acted it out, obviously. I have another pastor friend that did cross-dressing as an adult. And there are reasons for that happened to him. One time, a young gal named Carolyn came in, and Carolyn had just the few days, maybe about a week before, had taken her fingernails and had literally scraped them and gouged them deeply within each of her cheeks down to her chin. And the blood was profuse. And when they found her, now she was in, I believe at this time, about in her mid-20s, they found her in the closet sobbing and weeping. Well, it was about a week before I could be able to see her, and she came in, and she came in with a friend, and we began to talk. And one of the things that kept being a repeated scenario or line was the criticism that she would hear her father give her. You see, her father wanted the daughter to act like a boy. And so when a daughter would approach a thing as God has designed a woman to approach an issue, he instead wanted her to approach it like a man. And so because she did not think like a man, he would say to her repeatedly, "Don't you have any gray matter between your ears?" Implying, "You dumb, stupid, blonde, you, if you had a brain of a duck, you'd fly backwards." Here she is, almost destroyed in adulthood because of the root hurts in childhood. The text I'd like to use for our session today is found in Colossians 3:21. It is probably one of the most powerful verses and condensations of truth on parent-child relationships we find in Scripture. Now, there are many fine passages in Scripture. I didn't say it's the only one. I said it's one of the most profound. Because if you crack each of these words open like a nut and take out the meat of each one of these words, you would be amazed what God identifies with things that cause children to hurt. The New American Standard translates Colossians 3:21. It says, "Fathers," and I include mothers when I use this verse, so you can insert mothers here as well, because I find it's by gender. Anyone, both genders are doing this. "Fathers and mothers, do not exasperate your children that they may not lose heart." And the Amplified says that, "Fathers, do not scold your children so much that they become discouraged and quit trying." The King James obviously renders it, "Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged." You see, this is a function that is done by parents. The passage identifies fathers as being perhaps more culpable, more responsible, more prevalent in doing this. But I think what we're seeing in this age of blurred gender lines, that we see women acting out in the same way that men are acting out. But this is a function that's done by parents towards children. It's usually the fathers are the more apt to do it because they have less of a compassion for the feelings of the children. And I think that's the reason mothers don't do this as much, is because they are concerned with the feelings of the child, where the father may be more concerned with the correctness of the action. And they get caught up in the logic of the situation and totally ignore the feelings. The word provoke here, or exasperate, means literally to habitually nag at, to irritate. Now this is done in at least three ways. The first way is by demanding commands. Now it doesn't say just commands. It says demanding commands. It's where the parent is constantly demanding, commanding obedience. Now, listen, I've raised two daughters. I have a grandson. And there are times you have got to be rather clear, hopefully all the time, clear, explicit to the child what they're to do. But you see, often our commands have no seasons of grace in it, seasoning of grace. Take the word please for a moment. Just stop for a moment. Stop with me for a moment. If a child does not hear the word please from a parent, where are they going to hear it? Now those of you here, listen carefully. Where are they going to hear it? You see, often we demand of our children, and I've done this, that they say yes sir, no ma'am, or whatever, and we expect them to say please, and they are to see this modeled in a vacuum. Now I don't mean Billy, pass the spaghetti, please. Whoa. He says, well, I said please. That's true, but you said it in anger, and you might as well just skip the word please. By demanding commands. Demanding. You do this. You get over there. And I realize a need for firmness. But what exasperates, provokes a child is when the spirit of the instruction is always a demeaning, or usually a demeaning, command. The second way of provoking, first one, a demanding command, is perpetual fault finding. Perpetual fault finding. I mean, it's just like you've got a radar fuzz buster in your mind, and you walk into the house and you turn that thing on, and rather than looking for the bears, looking for an officer of the law, you are looking for a flaw, an aberrant behavior, something that you can release some tension inside of you, some anger inside of you. And so it's critical. And so our mouths become like a Gatling gun or a 45 caliber mouth. We just shoot, 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 talk, 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 talk. It's constant, perpetual. Don't do this. Don't do that. Pick up that. Don't put that. Get your hands out of your ear. Keep your mouth out of your nose. Keep your finger off your nose. Do this. Don't do that. Now, don't hear. Don't correct your children. Pardon the double negative. But please hear the perpetual, incessant, never-ending, constant, perpetual fault-finding. Critical. If you and I, as moms and dads and grandparents, are noted for our criticism, that is not one of the fruit of the Spirit. That, my dear friend, is the fruit of the flesh. And if you and I are stuck in the mode of perpetual fault-finding and criticism, usually there is a large reservoir of anger underneath that you're letting out that has nothing to do with a child. Perpetual fault-finding, third thing that causes a child to be provoked, is just interference for interference sake. Interference for interference sake. Usually this is done by a parent who needs to be in control all the time and is constantly having a need to protect his or her image in front of other people. There's no respect for boundaries at this point. I have two daughters. One's married. One now that's 11 years old, going on 18. She has her own room. She has a door in that room. Now, when I walk to the door and the door is closed, technically, as a parent, I have every right and perhaps maybe reason to open that handle and walk right in. But out of respect for the 11-year-old, I knock. Now, does that mean I knock every single solitary time? If there's something I feel that is a higher issue than just respecting a boundary, I go in. But you see, she may be dressing. What this tells her, that people must ask permission in order to enter her space. Because if there are no boundaries in our lives, just as if there are no boundaries in a football field, and you could take that ball and run anywhere you want with it, obviously the game loses a lot of effectiveness. Children need to have legitimate boundaries. If you march over all of their boundaries, say your daughter's, when she dates a young man and this young man starts making love by the Braille method, that's right, and she feels, well, I might as well, it must be okay because he's doing it. Often that's the thinking of a victim who's been incessantly in incest by a parent, a relative, neighbor, brother, or somebody. But interference. Walk in the room. What are you doing? What are you doing? What do you say? What are you? And it's just kind of like, well, it looks like you're having a good time here. What are you guys doing? It's just the child comes home, and it's very appropriate. And you should ask them, how'd their day go? But it's, come here, sit down. Now, what'd you do today? Who'd you talk to? What'd you say? What'd they say? It's just interference for interference sake. It's getting in that child's face, repeatedly asking questions. You're at Bobby's. What'd you play? Who won? And you say, that's kind of ridiculous and extreme. That's very true. But many times, when that child gets to be an adolescent, we have forgotten that they've got one foot in childhood and one foot in adulthood. And frankly, they're heading for adulthood. And there may be a time where we have got to respect some of their boundaries, even more so. I chuckle when I hear parents say, well, I found a letter to my daughter that was on top of her dresser, unopened, but I just felt I needed to know. Now, there may be an occasion, emergency come up, where, you know, the child's in drugs or something, where that would have to be appropriate. But then quite often, the child has no boundaries, and interference is given for interference's sake. The expression provoke not happens to be in what we call the present tense. What that means is do not keep on nagging your child. Now, you may not be aware of, but during World War II, one of the things that our GIs who were in Chinese concentration camps, even Japanese for that matter, they would come and they would say, they would discuss what's called a Chinese water torture. And they would take a prisoner of war and tie them down to the ground and put above their head a bucket of water with a hole in that bucket or container. And the water would drip out of that bucket, drip at a time. Now, anyone in the right mind knows that no big deal to start. Drip, 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 drip. Drip, 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 drip. And we're thinking, what in the world is this all about? But hour after hour of that dripping worked on the minds of those GIs, and some of them lost their minds, went berserk, because of the incessant interference, perpetual fault finding, the constant barrage that was coming into that child. And the result, many of them just shut down. They went into almost like a comatose depression, where in their minds, their body functioned Or we would say the lights are on, but nobody's home. You see, as a habit, this provoking is taking place. And by the way, when it says, parents, do not provoke your children, this happens to be a command of God to parents. This is not advice. You and I, as parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, we don't have an option on this. Now, you may think, you know, here that you can choose to not do this. I would just encourage you to understand that God's Word is inspired by God's Spirit, not just the general ideas, but the words. And the tense voice mood, in this case, the mood here is a mood of command. It's God saying, don't you do it. In fact, this word is only used twice in the New Testament. It's used here negatively, but it's used positively in 2 Corinthians 9:2 in a good sense. For I know your readiness to give has been prepared since last year, and your zeal has stirred up or provoked most of them. And that is a positive provoking. The expression is verse to anger. Frankly, it is not in the original text. In the King James, it's added, and I believe it's appropriate to add it. It's very strongly implied. But the verse goes on to answer the question, what is the result of sinful provoking? What is the result? Well, the verse says, in order that they may not lose heart, or lest they be discouraged. Amplifying says, shut down. Fathers, don't scold your children so much that they become discouraged and quit trying. Now, that's what I see in adulthood, where men who function, you know, impeccably in their calling, chosen vocation, but it comes to home, relationships, again, they've shut down. And why have they shut down? Well, this verse here happens, the verb there happens to be in a present subjunctive, and all that means is keep on being discouraged. Or, as another translation gives it, they keep on losing heart throughout life. In other words, the provoking, the disheartening that happened in childhood has caused them to think in their minds in adulthood, why try? And that's why often I will have adult child after adult child. They have married someone to take care of them. Men have married women to take care of the men. Women have married men so the man would take care of the woman. It's all an immature perversion that's being acted out. Again, this word is only used here in the New Testament, the word discouraged or lose heart. The word discouraged or lose heart literally means to lose spirit or courage, to lose a spirit of the heart, be discouraged. May I just say it another way? The word courage means I control fear and I control loss, and the fear of loss. If there's a major accident out here in this intersection in front of this auditorium, and I will go out there and there's a major accident and the cars are engulfed in brilliant flames, and you know, I'm really a natural born coward. Some people have to work at it, but I right from the beginning I have a low pain threshold and I don't like pain. So, but I hear crying coming out of that car, and I can hear that, so I run up to the car and I just glimpse in there and I can see a child in the front seat, and I grab the handle of the door and I rip that door open and I lunge inside and strap that child, and all the time the flames are licking at my face and burning my hands, and I grab that child and I get that child out and I roll a child on the ground and I get the fire off of them. And after the adrenaline dissipates in my system, pain begins to excruciatingly scream out in my body. The next day, the headline says, "Preacher demonstrates courage." What they mean is that a preacher, a person, has overcome the fear and the loss that would be caused by exposing himself to these hot flames, overcame that to help somebody else. That's courage. Now, the D-I-S in front of the word courage is a negative. No courage, discourage. So discouragement is when the fear and the fear of loss controls me. That's why I can sit in my office, at my desk, and have a kind of like a fog come in, like a San Francisco fog coming through the bay, and come up to me, and I begin to feel, oh boy, you know, discouraged. And I ask myself, all right, Chuck, what do you fear? Or what loss are you experiencing? Or what fear of loss are you thinking about? Well, I just, this person said they're going to be here, and it was a very important meeting, and they didn't come. So I lost the benefit of that meeting, rather than say, you know, I wish that person would have shown up, and yes, I'm going to experience some losses because they didn't show up, but I'm not going to let that fear or the loss or perceived loss control me. So what happens, a child gets discouraged, is that his losses just keep mounting up. He cannot do anything right. And so he just lets all the loss, let all the fear, I just can't do it. I just fear, I guess if I try it, it's not going to work. So I have a fear of failure. So the fear of failure becomes almost as automatic as his breathing. That's very hurtful. The expression, it breaks his spirit, and he senses that what he does leads to constant blame. The word provoking here means to break the spirit. And the son or the daughter believes, and he senses that whatever he does or whatever she does will ultimately lead into constant blame, and being blamed, feeling bad. And so he or she loses hope of ever being able to please or ever receiving approval. And so for some, they become incurable, and I say that in quotes, perfectionists. They become performance-oriented people, where they try like crazy to please. Now, you that are listening to me, you're looking at somebody who has been very approval-oriented. My father was an alcoholic. I had a praying mother, but a delinquent father. A tremendous amount of shame I have felt as a child. My dad wanted his wine, women, and song. He didn't want his sons. And so the meaning I put on that event, there must be something wrong with me. Otherwise, he would want me. But you say, I then became a performance-oriented people to get someone to like me. But when you're raised in a very critical environment where there's constant demanding commands, perpetual fault-finding, interference for interference sake, after a while you get that feeling, I can't please, and dadgummit, why try? Some of you sitting right here, yes, you, have stopped trying. And I want you to know I don't blame you. But may I say something to you? It's okay to try. I can do all things that God expects of me through Christ, who gives me the strength to do it. Quite often, I will hear someone in the counseling room say, I just burst into a rage. I suck it up, I swallow it, and then I just, after a while, I can't hold it any longer, and I just burst into a rage. Well, rage, frankly, is made up of two ingredients at least. The first ingredient is anger. The second ingredient is shame. You're sweeping the walkway in front of the house. Your dad comes out. He says, "You're not sweeping that walkway right. You're leaving leaves down there." There's the anger. Then comes the shame. "You stupid kid, when you gonna learn how to sweep a walk? Look, you dummy, get out of the way, let me show you. It seems like when I want something done right, I've got to do it myself. Now get out of here." That's the shaming. And just like hydrogen, you know, H2O, and oxygen, you mix them separately, you've got hydrogen and hydrogen and oxygen. But if you put those together, two points, I guess, two parts of oxygen, you get a third product that don't resemble the first two. It's called rage, called water. That's why the ingredient's called H2O. Well, Chuck, you, you're painting parents pretty badly here. May I just be completely honest with you? All parents do what I have just described to a lesser or greater degree. Dr. Hughes once said, "No parent, however kind, loving, considerate they may be, can fully meet a child's basic personality or psychological needs. Thus, all of us arrive in adulthood with some lack or need somewhere. Now, to the extent that we allow Jesus Christ to fully meet our needs, to that extent," Dr. Hughes says, "we stop using childish, immature ways to face the pressures of life." That's one of the reasons in our offices we can't keep on the bookshelf. They just go so fast. David Seaman's book, Putting Away Childish Things, I recommend that. In fact, I recommend most everything David writes. He writes the kind of books I wish I would have written. You see, releasing childhood ways begins by putting aside childish thoughts, but you can't put away childish thoughts. Do you know what in the world they are? Or actions? That's why Paul in 1 Corinthians 13:11, he says, "When I was a child, I used to speak as a child, rage, anger, whatever, think as a child, reason as a child." But notice this very familiar passage goes on to say, "When I became a man," or "when I became an adult, I did away with childish things." And that verb, "I did away with," is an active verb. It wasn't something that dropped off naturally. It was a process. Most of us here are still using childish coping mechanisms. You may think to yourself, "Not I." But you know why you don't think you are? Because what you think you're doing is normal and natural. Have you ever seen anyone throw a tantrum? Okay. That happens to be a childhood toy or a tool used by an adult to get his or her way. And if you were to ask them, "Where did you learn to do that?" they may even look at you like, "What's wrong with you? Does everyone throw a tantrum?" Usually what's happened is that they have fixated or stuck themselves or been stuck through emotional hurt at a very young age. But you see, every family has failures. That's why Romans 3:23, when it explicitly says, "For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God," basically means that a "for all have sinned and fallen short" Chuck met and married a "for all have sinned and fallen short" Linda. And we form a "for all have sinned and fallen short" marriage, just like you did. There are no perfect marriages, and there are no perfect parents. Now, I have worn out many metaphorical 2x4s on people's craniums, their heads, trying to break through the denial of the anger they have for their parents. And my goal is never to dishonor parents. I wasn't there when they did their parenting. God didn't die, leave me a charge. I'm not their judge. However, either by perception or actuality, if that child, now adult, thinks that that parent hurt them, then that child needs to release and forgive that parent. And that's why I try to have a person see the kinds of hurts and violations that may have taken place in that child's life, but it's not for the purpose of bashing the parents. You say, well, I just can't hardly, my mother knew I was talking like this. I says, wait a minute. Is it more loving to be subtly angry at your mother and a passive-aggressive anger person that just kind of always sarcastic and down deep would just like to act it out? Is that more biblical than saying, you know, my mom, my dad did sin against me, but now by faith in Jesus Christ, I give them what Christ gave me and I forgive them? Frankly, truth and honesty is more biblical, and God is more glorified. When you read Matthew 10, 34 through 37, it's pretty interesting. Most people don't understand what this means. Jesus said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth." I didn't come to bring peace. Wait a minute. Didn't the angel say peace on earth, goodwill to all men? He sure enough did. But frankly, we also know that until the king takes his kingdom and our Lord comes back and sets up his kingdom, there will need no peace. Until the Prince of Peace is in power and on his throne on earth, there will be no full peace. He says, "I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." Oh, we'll read the rest of the verse. Next part of the verse. "For I came to set a man against his father." You're kidding me. "And a daughter against her mother." What are you talking about? "And a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies," and this is the bottom line, "and a man's enemies will be the members of his household." Notice the next verse. "He who loves, honors, prefers father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." The context perhaps is talking about if you choose to be faithful and loyal to your family at the exclusion of expressing faith in Christ for salvation, obviously you have honored your parents above God. But another aspect of that is that if you choose to not see your parents in a realistic, honest, truthful light, then you are refusing to use God's grace and God's tools that He of forgiveness and healing that He wants to bring. And you are more concerned of your parents' approval than being obedient to God. I travel, you know, many, many thousand miles a year. And I tell audiences everywhere that I'm in the ministry today for at least two reasons. First one, I have a praying mother. I have a praying mother. Remember I said I had an alcoholic father, divorce home. But the second ingredient is I have a forgiven father. I have a forgiven father. You know, I am probably a little more closer to my mom than my dad. His mom invested time, energy, space, her life with me. My dad absented himself. He was gone. So I've had to build relationships with my own father. But my mother and I are very tight. My dad and I are tight. We've built, rebuilt. God's been good there. But you see, if we honor our parents, we do not see what they have done. And every parent has done something. We won't forgive them. And therefore, we are not free to love them. And frankly, I think it's God's will that every parent be forgiven and every parent be loved. That's my personal opinion. If you want chapter and verse, stick around the break and we'll give you chapter and verse. Well, by the way, this is all introduction. This is all introduction. What I'd like to do now, if I can, if you look at your notes, is I want to look at least six or seven ways that, and these are not all the ways, and there's more, but kind of a Reader's Digest version, ways of that we exasperate, that we've talked about here, our children, in very practical ways. But I just don't want to dwell on the, this is what you shouldn't do. I'd like to also add in this proposition, not only what are the seven ways to exasperate the children, but how can I correct this kind of behavior in and towards my children? Number one, how in the world do we do this? Probably if I was to list them, if not the top, one near the top, of things that really cause children to grow up with a love-hate emotion. They love their parents, but they hate what their parents have done to them. And that's the love-hate relationship. If one thing the parents have done is this thing called overprotection. Notice I did not say protection. Will you please hear the emphasis on overprotection? Or control of the child for fear of the child's or parents' hurt or loss. You see, parents, we as parents fear the pain of loss. I do. I fear the pain of loss either personally, me experiencing, me going through it, or vicariously seeing my children or child go through it. And so, many of us perhaps have experienced so many losses in childhood growing up. We have purposed in our hearts that when we get into adulthood, we are going to be in control and minimize the losses. The dear friend, control is a joke. Control is an artificial, deceptive feeling. For example, this circle I've drawn up here on the chalkboard, actually marker board. See this circle? All right, then I have a circle drawn outside of that circle. So I've got this inner circle that's like a yolk of an egg, and then they have the outer perimeter of this circle. Okay, the inner circle is our control zone. We control, protect, watch our children. But what often we fail to realize is that there is also an outer control zone that God controls and manages. Now, this is only an analogy. Obviously, they're blended. This is not either or. In fact, we're told in Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord guards the city, that's the big outer circle, the watchman keeps awake in vain. That's the inner circle. Now, if the watchman thinks that he's totally responsible and ultimately responsible for everything he sees out there, he could have a nervous breakdown. Actually, nerves don't break down. He has a coping breakdown. But a balance is that watchman watches tenaciously the best he can. But ultimately, in the back of his mind, he knows that unless God protects the city, he's watching in vain. And when a parent becomes neurotic over overprotection of a child, he or she thinks that he or she is totally responsible for that child. And true, we are responsible. No one would take that away from any of us. But the key word here is ultimately. If you do not ultimately believe that God is the one who's going to protect, keep your child, you will act like You are going to be God.